Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at WILL.UIUC.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today live on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. To invade Iran or not to invade Iran? Such is the dilemma facing the leaders of the United States today, and how the new news media cover this issue, how Americans are to understand it. This will be the subject of today's show, and our guest will be someone who's visited Iran, who's studied the issue, and has interviewed some of the leading experts on Iranian politics and Iranian-American relations. Our guest will be David Barsamian, today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Just before Alberto Gonzalez ended his reign as Attorney General, the Department of Justice submitted a late filing to the FCC against net neutrality, the principle that prevents internet providers from speeding up or slowing down web content based on its source, ownership, or destination. Free Press, the national nonpartisan media reform group that coordinates the SaveTheInternet.com coalition, filed a Freedom of Information Act request to find out whether industry lobbyists or White House pressure may have influenced the Justice Department. Marvin Amori, general counsel of Free Press, says the DOJ filing came long after the comment period had officially closed.
When we looked at the filing, we noticed that there is nothing special about the filing that would require them to be late. There's no evidence that the DOJ took. There was no hearings that they held. There's no outreach they had to any of the organizations that supported or opposed net neutrality that we knew about. And so when the DOJ filed this boilerplate document that seemed to have nothing but AT&T's talking points in it, 6 weeks later, it looked remarkably fishy. So we filed the FOIA to try to figure out who they talked to. So we wanted to find out if they had been contacted by or been in contact with the companies that oppose net neutrality, like AT&T and Verizon.
The filings from the Justice Department came just 3 days before Gonzalez stepped down.
It struck us that this seemed to be a favor from Alberto Gonzalez on his way out to AT&T and Verizon. And as it turns out, the day that George Bush announces his appointment for a new attorney general, he appoints an acting attorney general who's a longtime AT&T attorney, and Peter Kessler.
Other top administration officials with ties to the phone company include White House counselor Ed Gillespie, who was a key AT&T lobbyist. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, AT&T ranks as the second largest donor in American politics since 1987. Its employees have supplied candidates on both sides of the aisle with over $22.5 million since 2000. Thus far, there has been no response to the Free Press inquiry from the Justice Department.
Saturday, September 22nd, is One Web Day. This is an event that was started last year by Susan Crawford, visiting professor at the University of Michigan.
One Web Day is an Earth Day for the web. The idea behind One Web Day is to have a day, always September 22nd, which is an echo of Earth Day, which is always April 22nd, a day when people step back and reflect on how the web has changed their lives and do things in public places that are good works for the future of the web.
One Web Day is a truly global effort where people take positive action through videos or blogs to show how the web has changed their lives, or by teaching someone else how to make the web a stronger communications tool, like how to edit a wiki or set up a router. And there are other ways of celebrating as well.
In Ethiopia, they're opening up a bunch of internet cafes and workstations so that people can have internet access. In Bulgaria, there's a fight on behalf of bloggers who have been punished by the government for one reason or another, and that's being focused on One Web Day. In Austin, Texas, there's a sort of a teach-in at a cafe where people are getting together to talk about the web. It's very important that people understand that the web really is made of people and not machines, and that it is under threat around the world in a variety of ways, from gatekeepers of all kinds, censorship, inadequate access, lots of incumbents who are worried about their business models being undermined by the Internet. So many of the activities are aimed at creating a global constituency that self-consciously feels that it is responsible for the web.
For more information about One Web Day, go to www.onewebday.org.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact.
63% of American adults listen to the radio every day, says a new survey from the American Media Services. And the number among 25 to 34-year-old adults is even stronger. 79% tune in to radio at least once a day. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live today. And it's our station located, of course, in Campbell Hall in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, the United States is in one war in Iraq, another war in Afghanistan, and is contemplating a third war, this one in the country sandwiched between those two countries, Iran. Our guest today has been to Iran, he has studied the area, and he has conducted interviews with numerous experts, both American and Iranian. The result of his labors is a new book, Targeting Iran. Our guest, David Barsamian, is known to many of our listeners. He's the award-winning founder and director of Alternative Radio. His program appears on hundreds of radio stations around the world. His interviews appear in magazines and periodicals globally as well. His latest books, in addition to this, are Speaking of Empire and Resistance with Tariq Ali and Imperial Ambitions with Noam Chomsky and Original Zin with Howard Zinn. It's my honor to welcome to Media Matters today David Barsamian.
Thank you, Bob. It's wonderful to be on your program.
David, why did you decide to do this book, Targeting Iran? What was your motivation?
Well, one was to provide information about a part of the world and a country in the Middle East that is barely known to most Americans beyond cliches and platitudes. And if you were to ask the average American to, what would be the first thing they would say about Iran of a certain age group, they'd say the hostage crisis. But Iran also has a memory that precedes the hostage crisis, and we talk about that in the book, for example, the overthrow of a democratically elected government in 1953 by the CIA, Operation Ajax. This was commanded by President Eisenhower at the time. He told the Dulles brothers to go ahead and overthrow this democratic regime, because it had nationalized Iranian oil. Iranian oil, up to that point, had been a totally owned subsidiary of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Corporation, which was the precursor to British Petroleum, incidentally. And 100% of the profits from Iran's oil were being expatriated out of the country, going to England, and Mossadegh's decision to nationalize the oil was seen as a great threat. This coup was so significant. Not only did it crush the real democracy movement in the Middle East, arrest it completely, brought back the tyrannical Shah, who then rules for the next 26 years in Tehran, paving the way for the Islamic Revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini and 1979, this coup also became the template for subsequent coups. In the very next year, the CIA overthrew another democratically elected government, this one in Guatemala. But the one in Iran is particularly stinging to the Iranian people, and it's something that they're very conscious of and mentioned to me on numerous occasions. And that's one of the reasons we explore some of the coup background and the implications of this coup, because one of the persistent patterns in U.S. foreign policy is the refusal to see or even acknowledge that there are consequences from actions. I think most Americans now will feel at least somewhat confident when we talk about the Afghan Mujahideen being armed and financed by the United States and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan in the 1980s. And the consequences of that are very clear. Those Afghan freedom fighters, as Reagan called them, morphed into the Taliban, and some of them became al-Qaeda. And so in the similar way, what happened in Iran was extremely detrimental, extremely damaging to Iran's political evolution. Iran had a Congress, a Majlis, in the early 1900s. They were not only talking about democracy, they were trying to implement it. But so this particular coup had extremely deleterious and pernicious effects. And, you know, it's interesting, Bob, if you look back in the documents, and it's discussed in the book as well, Targeting Iran, that the CIA issued a kind of, you know, a sum up of the operation afterwards. And in this sum up, they used for the very first time the term blowback. That is the unintended consequences of a U.S. foreign policy action. And they warned that in the case of Iran, by destroying this nascent democracy, that it could lead to unforeseen consequences. Well, that's exactly what happened.
Our guest, David Barsamian, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're discussing his new book, Targeting Iran, which includes an introductory chapter by himself, as well as three lengthy interviews with Noam Chomsky. And you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation here,
sure.
David.
Sure. Ervant Abrahamian, who's one of the most distinguished Iranian scholars and historians. And the third participant in the book is a brilliant Iranian woman. She's based in New York now. She's multilingual, incredibly talented. Her name is Nahid Muzaffari. So the way the chapters are kind of divided is that Chomsky takes U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Iran and focuses on that. Ervant Abrahamian, on the other hand, looks at Iranian foreign policy and Iran's, I would say, singular structure of government. If you like, I can explain what that means. It's a very unusual political structure. And the third chapter, Nahid Muzaffari, she focuses on art and resistance, the role of culture and resistance. Some listeners may be familiar with Iran's extraordinary film industry that's, you know, operating under very difficult circumstances. Nevertheless, it has some world-class cinematographers and directors and screenplay writers. For Iranians, they're household names, but I'll just mention a few. Majid Majidi, Jafar Panahi, Ghobadi, Kiarostami, Mokhlabaf, and many others. Of course, people here also know about Iranian poetry. Jalaluddin Rumi, the great Sufi poet, wrote in Farsi. He was culturally Iranian, although he was born in Afghanistan and is buried in Turkey. He is the most widely read poet in the world today, translated in scores and scores of languages. And the Iranian tradition, oral tradition of poetry, is very, very strong, very powerful, and highly developed. It's not just Rumi, but there's Sa'di and Hafiz and Nizami and Jami and Ferdowsi and many, many others, right down to the present day, as Nahid Muzaffari in that chapter points out. A couple of years ago, the greatest contemporary Iranian poet died, Ahmad Shamlou, and over 100,000 Iranians turned out to honor him in the funeral procession. And Shamlou was able, by cleverly using double entendre, to get in a lot of jibes in against the regime.
Our guest today, David Barsamian, author of the new book, Targeting Iran, which includes a long essay by himself as well as three interviews. And this book, I must say, David, is really a superior introduction to the topic for someone who doesn't know a great deal. And I think that includes almost all Americans, unless they're experts in Iran. And your opening essay in particular, I found extremely illuminating, and just sort of understanding Iran as a country, its history, its people, how it got to where it is, and how it views the world from its perspective. And maybe just for the sake of our listeners, David, if you could just explain a little bit about Iran to differentiate it from its two neighbors, Iraq and Afghanistan, who Americans have learned a little bit more about in the course of the past 5 or 6 years. But what is there distinctive about Iran that most Americans probably don't know that would help them understand the country?
One thing I, you know, sensed even before my most recent trip to Iran in February, when I spent a couple of weeks there, and I had been there a few decades earlier during the Shah's period, is that Iranians have a very strong and keen sense of their Iranian-ness, their civilization, their history, their traditions. This is a civilization that has been extant for some four, maybe five millennia. So very, very sophisticated. They're extremely proud of their language, which is not Arabic. It is not a Semitic language. It's an Indo-European language. In other words, it derives from the Sanskritic tradition. So it's much closer, let's say, to Urdu and Pashto and Hindi and Bengali and languages like that than it is to Arabic. Arabic is a Semitic language. The Arabs are Semites. So there is a sharp divide there in terms of language and race and culture. And the Iranians are very aware of this, that they are, you know, that they are singular, that they are quite apart and different from their Arab brethren just across the border in Iraq. In Afghanistan, the cultural differences are not as acute compared to the Arab states. Many of the Afghans, half the population of Afghanistan speaks Farsi, the national language, of Iran. So the civilizational ties there are very, very strong. And the another state we can mention, another border state, is Turkey, which is also very different from Iran. It's a Turkic group, a different ethnic background as well, linguistic base. Now, I think one of the things that might confuse Americans when they see Farsi written or hear it, you know, it's written in the Arabic script, but the Iranians have added four letters to Farsi. So instead of the traditional 28 Arab letters in the Arabic alphabet, the Iranians added four more letters to accommodate some unique Iranian sounds. Iran was Islamicized in the 7th century, 7th and 8th century, by the Arabs. Prior to that, it was Zoroastrian in terms of its religious outlook. This, you know, it's conveniently sometimes called, you know, fire worshiping, but Zoroaster was a great saint who lived millennia ago, a millennia in the past, and had developed a very interesting religion based on Zend Avesta, which is, you know, the good and evil, Ahura Mazda is what it's called. And this, too, you see present even today in Islamic Iran. There are certain pre-Islamic rituals, celebrations such as Persian New Year, which is called Nowruz. It's in the spring solstice in March every year. You see it in Iranian names as well. They're not all Quranic. That is, they're not all Arabic. There are many Iranian names that are, again, unique to that country and culture. They also have their own musical system. The poetry I've mentioned about the music, which I've looked into a little bit, again, very developed, very singular. They have classical modes upon which they improvise, and they have their own instruments as well as they've developed. So there's a real sense of Iranian-ness that distinguishes Iran from their neighbors, particularly the Arabs.
Our guest today on Media Matters, David Barsamian, author of the new book published by City Lights, has just come out, Targeting Iran, which features an essay by David Barsamian, followed by three long interviews with two Iranians and Noam Chomsky. And again, my pronunciation skills are so weak, I don't want to butcher any names. But I can read them and understand them as I read them. Our telephone number here at Media Matters at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. David, this book, especially the introduction, but throughout the book, and Noam Chomsky's interview goes into detail on this too, really chronicles the U.S.-Iranian relations going back before the 1953 U.S.-sponsored overthrow of the democratically elected Mossadegh government. But then looking at the 1979 revolution, followed by the Iran-Iraq War. And this is an episode, too, that is of singular importance, but not especially well understood by Americans. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, the Iran-Iraq War, Saddam Hussein's Iraq launches a war on Iran in September of 1980. The attack was aimed at Iran's oil fields, which are primarily in the southwestern quadrant of that country. It's called Khuzestan. And Saddam Hussein thought that the Iranians would be a pushover. They had just gone through an enormous upheaval, the Islamic Revolution. Many key cadres in the military either were executed or were driven into exile or imprisoned. And so Saddam Hussein thought it would be a piece of cake. He was to find out that Iranians, rallied around the new government of Ayatollah Khomeini to defend their national sovereignty. It was interesting to see the response of the United States and the other so-called Western democracies to this clear, unambiguous, non-controversial violation of the territorial sovereignty of a member state of the United Nations. They did not propose any Security Council resolutions. There were no sanctions imposed on Iraq. None were asked for. And I think that sends, sent a message to the Iranians about, so-called devotion to international law and the so-called double standards of the United States and the West in particular. So that made many, many Iranians very angry and bitter toward the United States, I must say. Billions and billions of dollars poured into Baghdad, into the coffers of Saddam Hussein. He was heavily armed. He was provided with intelligence by the United States, including satellite printouts of Iranian positions. By 1987, the U.S. Navy is actively engaging in the war on behalf of Iraq. And it was during this period that an event happened which was a huge blow to Iran, again, barely known about or reported on in the United States. On July 3rd, 1988, an Aegis cruise missile destroyer, this is a U.S. Naval vessel in the Persian Gulf, shot down an Iranian civilian airliner, an Airbus, killing 290 Iranians, 66 of whom were children. This was a clear act of international terror. The plane was flying in international airspace. It was not in any way approaching the U.S. vessel, nor could it pose any danger, even if it did. But nevertheless, what was the response of the Reagan administration to the shooting down of the plane? Well, they gave a medal to the captain of the ship for committing this crime, which every Iranian that I met, still talks about. It's a very important issue, just as the way Americans remember the hostage crisis, which went on for 444 days 52 American hostages were seized in November of 1979 and then mysteriously released, you'll recall this, on the very afternoon that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, prompting speculation that some kind of deal was struck between the Americans and the Iranians to prevent the release of the hostages in a way that would reflect in a good way on Jimmy Carter, and particularly that it would not happen before the November election.
The famous October surprise.
Yes. Now, you know, the evidence on this, there are implications. To me, it is not clear-cut, but it is an extraordinary coincidence, and I think, you know, historians should be working on this. We'd like to know exactly what happened. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about the hostage crisis, because that is the defining moment in more contemporary U.S.-Iranian relations. All Americans will recall what happened. The embassy was seized in November of 1979. Now, this connects with the 1953 coup. Why? Let me explain. The 1953 coup, Operation Ajax, was run out of the American embassy in Tehran. All of the media, black ops, propaganda, the fomenting of strikes, the insurrection, all the propaganda that was, and all organizing of the coup was run by Kermit Roosevelt, who is the CIA officer in charge, grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, incidentally, cousin of FDR, and the embassy was the locus for the coup plotters. Everything was being run out of the embassy. Now, in 1979, the students felt, this is not to justify what they did, I want to give just an explanation. The students felt that the Americans, again, could use the embassy as the locus for a counter-revolution, to overthrow the Khomeini revolution and to bring the Shah back yet again. By this time, the Shah had fled. He was given asylum in the United States by Jimmy Carter after Jimmy Carter had promised the Iranians that they wouldn't let the Shah into the country, but then he did. Now, the Iranian suspicion that the embassy was going to be used again as a locus for revolution and overthrow of the government has some credence. We know for certain that Carter had dispatched a high-ranking American general, he was with NATO at the time, Robert Heuser, H-U-Y-S-E-R, with directions from the White House to make contacts with American allies in the Iranian military, high-ranking officers, to reverse the revolution, to overthrow the Khomeini government. Now, he didn't succeed. We know that, in fact, he went to Tehran and tried to foment a revolution. So the students had some, they had some reason for their action. Now, today, you know, in hindsight, almost every Iranian I spoke to decries the hostage crisis. They said it was, you know, it's very bad. It really hurt Iran, and also it led to the severance of diplomatic relations with the United States and Iran, relations that have not been yet established some 28 years later. And so they see the costs of that particular episode.
Our guest today, David Barsamian, author of the new book, Targeting Iran, published by City Lights Publishers. Our phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about Iran and the current conflict between Iran and the United States, which may well lead to bloodshed. For the balance of the show, let's go to the phone lines right now. We do have a caller. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with David Barsamian.
Good afternoon, David, Bob. I wanted to... I know that the Straight No Chaser is queued up and there's only a short half hour to go, but I wanted to applaud David's work, Alternative Radio, which has aired on, I don't know if you've done this at the top of the hour, but maybe we should do it at the half hour too, on WLL at 6 p.m. It's aired on the community station at 6 a.m., and I also wanted to mention that National radio projects, Making Contact, which hasn't been on the air here in the market in a while, in the area in a while. We almost got back on after being gone for maybe a year and a half, and I know you're one of the founding people with that. You can find it at radioproject.org. I wanted to ask you about what I heard Mansour Farhang say fairly recently. I don't know if you've done an interview or a speech by him lately, but we hear a lot about the Iranian interference in Iraq, but we don't hear a lot, and Farhang outlines that there are three fronts where the U.S. or the CIA is arming mainly dissident minorities to attack Iran, that this was sort of pointed to by the Cy Hirsch's New Yorker column anymore, but we don't hear much about it, and the allegation is that there is a hot war through proxies, our proxies, not the ones that we hear about all the time, and I wanted to know if there's something in the book about that or whether you're following that down, and again, thanks for all your great work.
Yes, thank you for the question and the comment. Indeed, in Targeting Iran, there is discussion about the movements that the United States is trying to foment to instigate a revolt, internal chaos and anarchy in Iran in several areas, not just three. Number one, with the Arabs in Khuzestan, in the southwest quadrant of the country. Mind you, tens of millions of dollars are going to fund and arm these groups, essentially, military formations, de facto military formations, to cause havoc inside the country with the hope of leading to regime change. That is the U.S. Goal in Iran, to overthrow the government and replace it with a client regime that is favorable to U.S. Military and corporate interests and will not in any way be belligerent toward Israel. Again, an important component of the entire U.S. Thrust in the Middle East today. Now, the Arabs are one group that they're funding. They're also funding the Azeri Turks in the northwest of the country. They're funding the Kurds on the western frontier. And they're also funding the Baluchis in the southeast corner of the country. And when I was in Iran, a bus was blown up by insurgents crossing over from, the Iranians were calling them terrorists. Perhaps that's more accurate, since insurgents doesn't quite describe it accurately. 23 people were blown up in this bus, a clear violation, number one, of Iranian sovereignty by Pakistani-based groups. And no comment from the U.S. government, who understandably so, since they're actually, actively funding and arming these groups. Now, this is, all part of the grand strategy to destabilize Tehran and to foment regime change. Iran was, in January of 2002, to its great consternation and dismay, I must say, is listed as an axis of evil state with Iraq and North Korea. Now, why do I say dismay and consternation? That is, you have to go back just to the months after the September 11th attacks on New York and Washington and know what the Iranians were doing in terms of cooperating and aiding the Bush administration. Iran was instrumental in supplying intelligence data to the Americans. As I said, half the population of Afghanistan speaks Farsi. Iran has deep, deep connections with the Afghan people. They have clients there who are sometimes called warlords that are beholden to them. And they use these assets. They help the Americans. They even offer to give safe haven and protect American pilots who would have been shot down. There was no such instance of that, but that was part of the offer. And then after the Taliban were ousted, the Iranians did the Americans yet another good turn. Hamid Karzai was extremely unpopular among the Afghan warlords who were meeting at a so-called international conference in Bonn, Germany in December of 2001. Now, why was Karzai unpopular? Well, because he hadn't lived in the country for many, many years. Like many of these, exiled Ahmed Chalabi in Iraq and others. Now, he had very little connection with the ordinary, you know, Afghan people. It was the Iranians at Bonn that twisted the arms of their allies to get Karzai seated in power. And so this was rewarded, I'm being ironic here, by the Bush administration by placing Iran as an axis of evil state. This was a really damaging blow to Mohammad Khatami, who was the president of Iran at the time, considered a moderate, someone who wanted to dialogue with the United States. This was a huge blow to his efforts to have some kind of reconciliation with the Americans. The Iranians that I met are not keen at all to have any kind of military conflict with the United States. They know what the odds are. They know who has the most powerful Air Force and Navy in the world. They know who has weapons of mass destruction and has used them in the past, has used chemical weapons in Indochina, depleted uranium in the first Gulf War and in the war going on in Iraq today. And so, you know, most Iranians want to have some kind of rapprochement. But I have to tell you, Bob, again, across the board, these people, Iranians are proud. I mentioned this earlier. They're very aware of who they are and their culture and their history and their, you know, traditions. And they don't like to be bullied. They don't want the mafia godfather giving them orders, you know, you do this, you do that. You know what the U.S. position is on negotiations with Iran on a whole range of outstanding issues? The position is basically like this. It's right out of Tony Soprano. They're holding a gun to the Iranian head and saying, you concede all of the points that we are demanding a priori, and then we'll sit down and talk. Well, no self-respecting individual, and certainly no self-respecting nation, would ever accede to that kind of bullying behavior. So, you know, in a way, the Americans are precluding the possibility for genuine negotiations, which I'm convinced the Iranians want, incidentally, you know, except for maybe a few hardliners, you know, who are chanting death to America. But, you know, I was in Iran on the celebration of the Iranian Revolution. It was February 22nd this year. And to watch the crowd, you know, chanting death to America, it seemed like really rehearsed theater. There wasn't much enthusiasm, you know, there wasn't much fervor. It was like really retro and old news. I think, you know, the revolution has lost quite a bit of its fervor, as revolutions do after a while once power is consolidated. The other thing that I talk about in the book, in terms of the dangers of a U.S. military bombing of Iran, apparently 2,000 targets have been selected by the Pentagon, and they're not just going to go after the facility at Natanz, where uranium is being processed. They are going to destroy the Iranian state, all of its infrastructure, bridges, highways, command and control centers, all military facilities, intelligence facilities, and the like. That is the intention of this bombing attack if it's launched. Now, Shireen Ebadi, who I talk about in the book, and I interviewed her as well briefly. She won the Nobel Prize in 2003, a very distinguished lawyer, a judge, a human rights activist. She told me the worst thing that could happen for the democracy movement in Iran, and believe it or not, there is a democracy movement there, would be for the United States to bomb the country, because people will rally around the regime and they'll defend the country, they'll support the regime. It'll have the exact opposite effect. She was literally pleading with me, you know, to somehow convince the Americans that this would be an extremely dangerous action to carry out, which will have very, very negative consequences. What some of those consequences are, I'm asked, I'm on a targeting Iran speaking tour. I'm going all over the country. I was just in Northern California. I'll be in Kansas City on Wednesday. I'll be in Detroit the week after that, and Seattle and Portland and L.A. and on and on. The question comes up at every single audience asks, well, what could happen? Well, Iran has enormous assets. It has, it has access to the Strait of Hormuz, which is a 20-mile-wide choke point linking the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean. This is the strait through which most of the world's oil tankers pass. It would not be difficult for Iran to either block the strait or to sink ships in the strait, effectively blocking it, which would, turn Friday's $82 a barrel for oil to $182 a barrel if there is a war. People are, complaining about $3 a gallon if they're paying for gasoline now. They'll be looking back at $3 a gallon with nostalgia. Wow, that was so cheap. Do you remember that? In 2007, we're only paying $3 a gallon. Iran can strike back in Iraq. It has, it has its religious, its Shia co-religionists there. Most of the main players in Iraq, the main political players, such as Jafari, the previous prime minister, Maliki, the current prime minister, al-Hakim, who heads the Supreme Islamic Council for Iraq, and the Badr Brigade, all of these were birthed in Tehran. These people were based in Iran throughout the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. They owe their political allegiance and their very survival to Tehran. So clearly Iran could inflict enormous damage on the United States, on the military there, who everyone concedes is way overstretched, way under-equipped, absolutely exhausted. Colin Powell said over a year ago, the army's at a breaking point. Well, some people say it's already broken.
David Barsamian, if I can interrupt, I want to let our listeners know this is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today, who you've been listening to, is David Barsamian, author of the new book, Targeting Iran. We are talking about Iran today on our program. You've been listening to David Barsamian discussing the prospects of a war, which he chronicles in his book, which includes interviews with several people, notably Noam Chomsky. If you'd like to call in, the number here again, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We do have a caller I'd like to get to, but first, David, if I could just ask you to touch really importantly on it, the issue that is at the center of the United States case for why military action may well be necessary with Iran, which, similar to the case for Iraq, is nuclear weapons. Could you just give a little background on the status of nuclear weapons and the U.S. argument and the Iranian position?
Iran is a signatory, as is the United States, to the NPT. That is the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Under Article 4 of the treaty, any signatory state has the right to develop processed uranium for peaceful purposes. The reason Iran is moving in the direction of processing uranium, and this is very important, I want your listeners to listen carefully, is because they say, rightly, that oil and natural gas are finite resources, that sooner or later they will diminish and ultimately disappear. So the Iranian state must take precautions for that eventuality. Now, why is this important? This is dismissed by the Americans and the others in Europe as saying, why does Iran have to develop processed uranium for peaceful nuclear purposes? It has all that oil and natural gas. Well, in the 1970s, when Gerald Ford was president and Henry Kissinger was his Secretary of State, the Shah of Iran instituted a nuclear reactor program and he gave the exact same reason that oil and natural gas were finite resources. Iran must look to the future and protect, the interests of its population. And at the time, Kissinger and Ford widely applauded Iran's decision and saying they're justified. Oil and natural gas are indeed finite resources. Now you have a complete volte-face, an about-face on this particular issue. There, according to Mohammed al-Baradei, who is the one person who I would really trust on this, he says that there is no indication that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, that it has not processed uranium in sufficient quantity and developed centrifuges, etc., to develop a nuclear weapon. But this is not the only charge that's being used for a casus belli. Much more than that is that Iran, in the New York Times, in a front page article, and a slew of other articles recently, of aiding and abetting the insurgents in Iraq. The U.S. is blaming Iran for the catastrophe it has unleashed on the Iraqi people. In fact, when I was in Iran, there was a very bad joke going around. You know, Iranians would say, you know, we know the Bush strategy to get out of Iraq. And I said, well, what is it? What do you mean? They're going to come through Iran. They were also blaming the Iranians for the Taliban in supplying arms and weapons to the Taliban. If anybody knows one scintilla about the differences between Wahhabi al-Qaeda-like Islam and Shia Islam, would know that these allegations are simply implausible. Al-Qaeda and the Wahhabi Islam that it represents, the Taliban in Afghanistan and al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, regard Shias, that is, Iranians are 90% Shias, Iraqis are 65% Shias, they regard them as heretics, that they should be annihilated, that they're not Muslims. So the idea that the U.S. has, you know, been putting forward, that Iran is supplying groups that are dedicated to Iran's elimination, is simply mind-boggling. And it reveals the depth, the colossal ignorance of people like Charlie Rose and Jim Lehrer and Thomas Friedman and all the other pundits that pundify in the corporate media.
Well, David Barsamian, what about the charge that Iran is singularly anti-Semitic, denying the Holocaust, wants to get rid of Israel, and that therefore, you know, the United States and Israel both have a right to sort of deal with it to make sure it can't put its anti-Semitic politics into practice?
The anti-Semitism is limited to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was a former mayor of Tehran. He was a member of the Revolutionary Guards in the 1980s. He fought in the Iran-Iraq War. In fact, that is the base of his constituency. His base, like Bush's base, largely in this country, consists of religious fundamentalists as well as retired and present military, because they identify him as a former war veteran. He has made now, it would take too long for me to explain what exactly was said and how it was said. In any case, he made a huge error, which Iranians are deeply ashamed and embarrassed about, and that is he hosted a Holocaust denier conference in Tehran in December of 2006. He invited such notorious characters as David Duke from the United States, Robert Faurisson from France, and he gave them, you know, this kind of state platform to put forth their absurd ideas, you know, that the Holocaust was fabricated, that, you know, or it didn't happen at all. I didn't meet a single Iranian who was not, you know, critical of what Ahmadinejad did. In fact, I met some students at the University of Tehran, you know, who told me, you know, for Christ's sakes, they didn't say Christ. They said, you know, we need jobs. You know, we don't need Holocaust conferences. We need the government, you know, creating a future for us instead of, you know, lining up enemies. So what Ahmadinejad is doing, he's playing the Israeli-Palestinian card in order to position Iran as the leader of the Islamic world. Now, this is a little far-fetched in my view and in the view of the writers in my book because of Iran's singular history and the fact that it is not an Arab-Sunni state. It is a Shia religious state, not a Sunni state. The majority of the world's 1.4 billion Muslims are Sunnis. The Arabs in huge numbers are Sunnis, except for the Iraqis and some Lebanese and Bahrainis. But of the 1.4 billion Muslims in the world, only 15 to 20% are Shia. So the Sunnis are the majority. Now, that an overtly Shia state, as Iran is, would try to become the leader of the Islamic world, it's a huge reach. It's highly implausible that other Muslims would go along with Iran. So I think it's, for political manipulation, he's trying to generate support for his other initiatives. He was elected in June of 2005 on a platform of improving the daily lives of Iranians. That has, in fact, gotten much, much worse. There's a huge amount of inflation inside the country. There's now gasoline rationing. There's, all kinds of economic problems. Many of the students that I met who were graduating this year or next year were telling me they're all going to move to Dubai or to Bahrain or one of these, Gulf Emirates, because there's no work in Iran. The regime is, not providing the kinds of services and opportunities that ordinary Iranians, desire.
David Barsamian, our guest today, author of the new book, Targeting Iran. We've been talking about Iran and the prospects of a U.S. invasion or attack upon Iran. We have two callers who have been waiting very patiently. I want to thank them. Let's try to get to them, let them have an opportunity to make their questions before the show wraps up. Line 2, Charleston, Illinois. You're on the air with David Barsamian.
Thank you very much. I feel almost guilty interrupting here, but I really called to talk about the nuclear issue, which David addressed fairly well while I was on hold here. I guess in one of his many famous public gaffes, the president said, "You fool me once, shame on you. Don't try to fool me again." And I get this eerie impression that we are simply trying to be fooled again. And I guess the question is, who can we rely on to give us a good estimate of what's going on in the Iraq nuclear program? And
the Iran nuclear program.
The alleged nuclear program, or the and why is the media just swallowing this again, and why, without any seeming question, that this is their goal?
Thank you very much, caller. And David, as you answer that, tack on to that at the very end, if you can, just a few words about the Democratic presidential candidates in the Democratic Party and what sort of alternative vision they're providing for an Iran policy.
We'll start with that because it's so grotesque and so obscene in my view. Nancy Pelosi removed from the most recent Iraq war appropriations bill a sentence that said the Bush administration cannot attack Iran without congressional approval. So her dedication to nonviolence negotiation, I think, was exemplified by her removing of that particular sentence. Almost all of the Democratic Party candidates, including Barack Obama, have said in lockstep, all options are on the table. Iran is very dangerous. We cannot, commit ourselves right now, but we have to, hold the possibility of some kind of military attack on Iran. In terms of information, actually, because the informational landscape has changed for the better in the United States in the last 5 or 6 years, I think you can get a lot of good information right here. In fact, you can read Al Jazeera.net in English for what I think is the best reporting on the Middle East. There's a whole host of websites. There's MERIP. There's the Institute for Policy Analysis. There's Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! There's my program, alternativeradio.org. A lot of places where you can, get the skinny on what's going down with Iran. But again, the major corporate media have been very, very vocal in essentially, as the caller suggested, replaying a lot of the propaganda tropes that we used against Saddam Hussein.
Are those working with the American people? What's your sense of, from traveling around the country, now you talked a lot of activists who are going to be peace activists, but I mean, do you sense we're getting this sort of rejuvenation of hostility towards Iranians like this country had in 1979 or 1980 and people geared up for another war?
It hasn't reached that level yet, but clearly, there is, particularly since Labor Day, as Andrew Card infamously once said, the former Bush chief of staff, you don't introduce new products in August. The product they introduced literally on September 1st, right out, or a few days before Labor Day, was to defame and demonize the government in Iran as a growing threat, a major threat, a destabilizing factor. Just read Bush's speech to the American Legion, or his speech to the Veteran of Foreign Wars, or his speech to the Marine Corps at Quantico, Virginia, last week, or even his comments when he went in the middle of the night to Anbar province in Iraq.
Dave, we've only got a little time left. I do have one more call to get to, but I want to follow up on this point. If, in fact, the United States did engage in this massive bombing mission to destroy the entire infrastructure of Iran, bring the country to its knees and its rubble, where, I mean, there's got to be a section of the people who run the United States foreign policy and economy who would think that might not put the United States in a very good position worldwide for a long time.
I think that would be correct. I mean, the amount of animosity that the Iraq and Afghan wars have generated toward the United States is simply stunning. I mean, I was recently in Turkey, which is a longtime U.S. NATO ally. 9% of the Turkish population had a favorable opinion of the United States. I mean, this is an extraordinary development, a direct result of the what I regard as imperialist, neo-colonialist policies of this administration in the Middle East to capture its resources and to dominate the global economy.
You know, I hate to cut you off because I could listen to you forever, but I do have one final caller, and we've only got a couple of minutes left. So let's go to line 4, Effingham. You're on the air with David Barsamian, author of Targeting Iran.
Hello. How much time do I really have?
Well, you know, I think you've got like 30 seconds for your question.
Oh, 30 seconds. Well, I think then I'll have to try to say something cogent in almost no time at all. A, you guys talk too much, and B, you don't give enough time for us, and C, I too think that the would be harmful to the movement of democracy to have a war break out between us and Iran, and I certainly do believe that there are people in Washington that are aware of that too. But the last point is, you know, I myself have lived through several things about which you have spoken, and I don't see what I lived through to equal what you're saying, and so to me, that puts most everything else you say suspect as well.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by that, sir? Hello. Oh, I think we lost him. David, I don't know. Do you ever? I don't know if you want to respond to that.
Well, it was unclear as to what the gentleman was referring to, as he has lived through several things. So it was just too obtuse and ambiguous.
No, I'm sorry he left. He certainly had more time to develop his thoughts than that. We didn't cut him off, and he was welcome to stay. I would have liked to have heard him finish that point, because I think he was trying to get to a major criticism there of what you've been saying, but it's unclear exactly what it was. Where do you think we're going to go, the United States, with regard to Iran, in the last few seconds, if you could?
Well, I think unless there is a popular movement in the country that either later this year or early next year, there will be a bombing attack on Iran. It seems that with the positioning of 3 aircraft carrier battle groups 150 miles off the coast of Iran, that is not just gunboat diplomacy. They're not there to soak in, you know, to work on their suntans in the Persian Gulf. They're there to exercise military force. They are the advanced phalanx, if you will, of the, you know, imperial war machine. And so unless there is action here in the country, unless impeachment is back on the table, Bush will not feel constrained, I believe, to go out, you know, in one last blast of shock and awe.
Well, David Barsamian, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio for Tavis Smiley. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today in Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back one week from today. Thank you all very much for listening.